Welcome to Madlit Musings, the podcast where we dive into the minds of authors, exploring the profound realms of faith, social issues, and the delightful world of entertainment. I'm your host, Jamie Jill Wright, and on this literary journey, you never quite know what you're going to get. Hey there, Madlit enthusiasts. Our podcast is sponsored by the esteemed Baker Publishing Group. Whether you're into heartwarming romance, gripping suspense, or deep dives into matters of faith and society, Baker Publishing Group has it all. With Revell and Bethany House Publishers under their umbrella, they bring you a diverse array of books that will captivate your mind and stir your soul. Check out all of their line at www.bakerbookhouse.com. Hi, everyone. It is Jamie Jill right here at Madlit Musings. And I'm just going to leave that in there because
we're off to a great start.
And we're off to a great start. Today, I have Erin Bartels with me here. Erin, take it away when you're ready, because I'm obviously not able to talk this morning.
Well, I'm very happy to be here. It's very exciting to start talking about this book because I haven't actually, I think you're the first interview that I'm going to be giving. Or maybe maybe the second, but I think the other one was a long time ago, so I don't really remember what I said.
You know, isn't it crazy? Like, I've done some podcasts for my book that's coming out ages from now, and then I'll do podcasts for the book that's coming out in a couple of weeks, and I'm like, I can't remember which book I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But we are talking specifically about The Lady with the Dark Hair.
Yes.
That's the title. Okay,
cool. That is
the title. Gorgeous cover.
Yes, gorgeous cover. I love it. They do such a good job with covers.
They really do. They do. The title too is intriguing. The Lady with the Dark Hair. It sounds like you're kind of like you're a witness to a something. And that's something. Like, what did the culprit look like? Well, it was the lady with the dark hair. But this is not what your book about, because you don't write suspense. So tell us what your book's about.
Yes. Yeah, so this is a dual timeline story where the past timeline starts in 1878 in Southern France, and the modern day timeline is in East Lansing, Michigan, which is sort of just down the road from me. And I chose that as the setting because then I wouldn't have to research that as well, because I did a lot of research for the past timeline. And the story is basically, there's this woman in the modern day, Esther, whose family has this small museum dedicated to the work of their ancestor, Francesco Vella.
Okay.
And Francesco Vella is sort of a minor painter during the Impressionist period. He doesn't exist. He's fake. So don't go look him up.
Fictional. Yeah.
Fictional.
I need to cancel my trip to the Louvre. Okay.
Yes. Yes. You won't find him there.
I'll find him there.
But they have this little museum dedicated to him, and they're trying to raise awareness of him, and they feel like he should be more well known. And this woman, Esther, reconnects with a former art history professor from her college, and wants to show him what she considers to be Vella's most important painting.
Okay.
And it's not at the museum, it's in her home. And when he looks at it, he sort of calls into question, like, are you sure this is his? So that sets Esther off on this sort of quest to prove him wrong. Of course it's his.
Right.
And it changes sort of the course of her life. She lives with her mother, who has suffered from schizophrenia for as long as Esther's been alive, and they live a very isolated life.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the past timeline, the main character's name is Viviana, and she is Catalan. There's going to be a lot of mispronunciations today. She's Catalan, and so she is from this area in northern Spain, where you would find Barcelona today, between Spain and France, and she is sort of living a false identity in southern France, and is working in the house of an artist, and this is how she interacts with this person, Francisco Vella.
Okay.
And so the past timeline is you're actually seeing, like, what is the real history here, and then the present is uncovering that history.
Uncovering it. Oh, that sounds really intriguing. And extremely European, like lots of European.
Yes,
I've
because they're
got
not
that.
just in France. There's other places that you'll encounter, especially in both timelines. You'll have some visits to Gibraltar, which I
Okay.
think is a really fun place because people don't typically know much about it.
Right.
And you don't get a lot of sort of Victorian age stories that take place in places other than England and usually America.
Right.
You just don't hear as much about what's going on the continent. And Gibraltar is a really fun place because it's very cosmopolitan. There's all these different cultures there because of its history of being fought over, and the British own it, but it's very Spanish as well. So it was really fun to do the research for that as well.
Okay. So there's really a lot of Spanish and French influence
Yes.
in this story, both past and present, if I'm hearing it
Indeed.
correctly then. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. That sounds exciting. Now, you were telling me right before we got on that there's enough foreign words that you had to talk to some.
Yes.
Do tell
Yeah.
us the
So
foreign
one
words.
of the ways that I did a lot of the research for this book was I have a connection with a former professor, an English professor of mine who's actually Gibraltarian. And he grew up in Gibraltar during a time when the border was closed with Spain. So he basically lived in this tiny area with it's very densely populated for
Okay.
the area and couldn't really leave
Wow.
for I think it was probably more than 15 years. I can't remember the exact years. And then he went to school in London and then came to the States and has taught here for, I don't know, 30 years or something like that. So I said, you have a lot of books about Gibraltar. You're the only person I know from that area. And it would be really fun to set a book there. So I got to interview him about life there, and they even speak a different dialect or language in
Okay.
Gibraltar that's not Spanish and it's not English, but it's both, and it's called Yanito. So he told me all about that particular dialect, and he was kind enough to I sent him a list of words in all these different languages, in French, Catalan, Spanish. There's something else too. Oh, and Yanito, and said, "Can you please record how to pronounce these for the audiobook? Because I am really afraid that it's going to be very wrong." So I was able to pass those on to the audiobook narrator, and she was actually we were able to talk back and forth and get some information because there's a lot of words like you'd pronounce it different ways in each of the languages. But I didn't remember exactly who said it in the narrative. So I'm like, well, it could be this, or it could be this person who's speaking French, but would be speaking it with a Spanish accent because they're actually
My
Spanish, or whatever.
gosh.
So I'm sure she's done a fantastic job. I'm very excited
Yeah.
to hear this one.
This sounds like one of those books that I'm definitely going to want to get, not just in paperback, but also get the audiobook because it
Yeah, and
almost
I
seems
don't
like it's
listen
going to
to
be a
my
different
audio.
experience.
Yeah,
Yeah.
I don't listen to my audiobooks typically because I'm always worried that they're going to be
Right.
mispronouncing chicken place names, which often they do, especially before I offered to give them a pronunciation guide. And they didn't really ask for one. I thought, well, this really takes you out of the story if you know how it's supposed to be
Right.
pronounced.
Right.
Yeah,
Yeah.
so it'll be fun to listen to this one, though.
That'll be really cool. Okay, so there's a lot of art in this book. So
Yes.
take us there. What made you go in that direction for the book? Is there a lost love of art in your own background?
Well, there's not a lost love of art. I actually make a lot of art myself. I've
Okay.
always been somebody who loved art class. I took extra classes outside of school, and I've really enjoyed the last probably, I don't know, maybe almost 10 years learning how to oil paint.
Okay.
And, when I was a kid, they give you watercolors because they're cheap and they're easy. And
Right.
they say, well, oil paints are messy and expensive. So you're just sort of like, oh, that's off the table. And then as an adult, every once in a while, you have these realizations. You're like, oh, I'm an adult. I can get this thing. I can try this thing. And that was one of them. When they put Bob Ross on
Yes.
Netflix, and I used to watch him all the time when I was a kid on
Me too.
PBS, and I was just like, oh, I've got to try this. It's clearly easy. So so
All
I
the
ordered
happy little
some
trees.
stuff, and
Happy little trees
yeah,
are so easy to
happy
make.
trees and happy little accidents and yeah, so I've really been enjoying it. And one of the fun things I did as I was sort of researching for this book was I gave myself a challenge to learn how to paint people because I only really paint landscapes and natural things and flowers and things like that. And I thought, well, I've never been great at drawing people, but you don't really have to draw to start painting. So I watched some YouTube and all that stuff, and I did a self-portrait each month of, I think 2022 was the year that I did that. And it was really fun to see like what got better, what got worse in between, because it's not a straight line like getting
Right, I'm
better.
sure.
But it was really, really fun. And portrait painting and self-portraits are a big part of the story. And
Okay.
for women painters, which there are many, many more female painters than you know about, because a lot of their work was lost or it was misattributed to men. They often didn't sign their work because of cultural expectations of humility, and also a woman shouldn't be doing this kind of work.
Sure.
So there's a lot of scholarship lately, in the past probably 10 or 20 years, finding these people and l learning about them.
Yeah.
And so for a woman who was not allowed to go to the academy and wasn't allowed to go into a life drawing class, the person that they painted the most sometimes was them or their family members. Because as long as you had a mirror, you had a model.
True.
So that's how they learned to paint, because they weren't allowed to go to school for it a lot of times. So I learned all sorts of wonderful things about the history of female painters, and I would love to recommend a book for people who are interested in that. It's called The Mirror and the Palette, and it's by a woman named Jennifer Higge, Higgie. It's really fascinating. So I would definitely recommend, if you're interested in that and sort of rediscovering female artists, great book.
You're right. Now that I think about it, you don't hear when you hear about all the famous paintings and the famous artists throughout the centuries, you don't hear about a lot of women.
Right. And I've been to a lot of museums over the past few years, doing sort of like just for myself, but also if this is my chance to see all these Van Goghs because they've come to the Detroit Institute of Art, I'm never going to have this chance again, because all of these are all over the world normally. So I'm going to go see that. And when you think about museum collections, they are overwhelmingly male and overwhelmingly European. And it's just starting to, people are just starting to think, okay, we really need to expand our collection and expand who we see as worthy of being in a museum.
Wow, that's really kind of cool, because I'm thinking back to when I went to the Uffizi in Florence, and I can't think of one female artist
Well,
that
and
was
there were
there.
so
Actually,
many
there weren't any,
Italian
but
masters who were
yeah.
male, but one artist I was very lucky to see a number of very famous paintings by a woman named Artemisia Gentileschi. Gentileschi, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that
That's
right.
a gorgeous name, even pronounced that way. So we'll take
Gorgeous.
it.
She was, and some of these women were famous in their day, and then they were just disappeared.
Oh,
They were
interesting.
forgotten,
Okay.
you know, and she
Yeah.
was probably the most famous woman painting at her time, or one of the
Okay.
most famous. And she should be there with the Caravaggios, you know,
Yeah.
like it's the same type of painting, and she was fantastic. Of course, now they, as people are deciding, I want these for my collection, that hopefully drives prices up so that these things are seen as being worth more, despite the fact that they were painted by women.
Oh, it's funny though, because I like to read Regency novels, not necessarily the romances and the corset busters, but just like the actual like Julie Clausen, good old
Yeah, it's
Southern
a
fair.
great time period.
And it's so interesting how many of them reference the women painting as hobbyists,
Yes,
their
so
watercolors and all that.
it was very acceptable for women, and most women of a certain station would have learned how to draw, how to paint, like botanicals, how to maybe ornament something. So, like if you were somebody who painted ceramics and you painted little designs, that was women's work. But to paint big paintings, religious paintings, paintings about Greek mythology, anything like that, that was not women's work. Women were not equipped for that. They couldn't, they didn't have the big enough emotions and the big enough feelings in order to carry that off. And I'm not making this up. I mean, like you can find,
That's
actually,
so
the book
funny.
begins with all of
Yes.
these quotes that I found, and it wasn't hard to find them about women, and just how worthless they are. And these are by famous people who are quoted all the time. You
Gosh.
know, Schopenhauer and Rousseau, and you know, it's and
Yeah.
so I open the book with these quotes that get worse and worse and worse and worse about women. And then you turn the page, and the dedication is for the women. Because this
Oh,
is a
no.
book that is about women who are trying to, who are up against certain expectations. There's societal expectations, there are expectations that we have of ourselves. And whether it's in the 1800s or today,
Right.
there are expectations and limitations to our lives. And these are women who are trying to kind of push against, what can I do that they say I can't do? Can
Yeah.
I really do it? Can I do this? Or am I going to have to defer to a man? Or am I going to have to take care of this instead of do the thing that I really feel called to do? So it brings up all those questions of what women spend their time doing and are expected to spend their time doing, and the things that
Right.
they're expected to leave to others.
Yeah.
So
Yeah.
yeah, it's definitely a book. I mean, I really hope that men read it and
Yeah.
thereby come to understand why so many women are so angry.
Because we don't, well, we
or
really can't say that we're
disappointed.
that angry though, because we don't have big enough emotions.
Right. There's a lot of contradictions there.
I think it is kind of funny to me, like, back then it was like the women didn't have big enough emotions to write about, Greek mythology or paint about Greek mythology, and yet now the stereotype is like, we're not just emotions, we're
Right.
also a brain.
Whatever the excuse, anything
Right.
to limit people.
Right. Yeah,
That's what it
exactly.
came down to.
Yeah. No, and that makes sense. Okay, so the lady with the dark hair, we have the two time periods, and I love the fact that you've got the story with kind of the family ancestry being wrapped around this art. Is that common too, like when you look at that at artists and then the generations as they go by, that there's kind of a familial attachment as well, or is that more of your
Well, it's interesting.
story?
I don't know. It's interesting when you think about artists. I've actually looked a number of people up, artists and writers and things like that. Every once in a while, I'm like, I wonder if there's anybody living who's their descendant. And a lot of them don't have
Really?
descendants. Like a
Oh,
lot of
good.
them didn't have families. They lived
Yeah.
an unconventional life and they threw themselves into their art, whatever it was. And then others, like, so if you learn a little bit about Van Gogh's situation, he didn't have any descendants, but
True.
he had a brother
Yeah.
and his brother's wife, and they were the ones who were trying to sell his paintings after he died so that they could, you know, make some money off of it to pay for things that they needed to pay for. And there'll be things that are in families, and then there'll be things that are, a lot of artists give things away to friends, and then sometimes they would have a show of their own work, and their supporters and friends who were working at the same time, Impressionists did this a lot, would often buy each other's paintings.
Oh,
And then
interesting.
they would end up with all of these things, or they would be given paintings as gifts from other
Sure.
people. And so their families would end up with those paintings.
That makes sense.
And then a lot of them end up being given to museums. A lot of them, you know, in a certain time period are bought by wealthy industrialists who want to look like they're old money when they're really new money, and they want to be more cultured. And then a lot of those get given to museums, or else they're still owned by the person who owns them and they are lent to museums. So a lot of times when you see something in a museum, it'll say under it who owns it. So when I was at an exhibit of Tudor art, so things from Henry VIII and Elizabeth I and that era, which was so exciting because you were like, oh, this is the picture of Henry VIII that I always saw in history books as a kid. Like, this is it. This is the painting.
The actual
And a
one.
lot of those things are technically owned by King Charles. So,
Oh, really?
and before him, they would have been owned by his mother.
I
So
suppose, yeah.
the royal family owns those things. And so there'll be a little note on the bottom of the placard that says that it's the property of King Charles III. And you're just like, oh, how nice of him to let us borrow this.
I suppose that makes sense with the royals. They wouldn't exactly like give the paintings away to a peasant in the street.
Right. Yeah, I think they have a lot of stuff floating out there in other places, which is all well and good because we all know the British stole so many things from other cultures. They may as well give back a bit.
Oh, funny. Well, this book sounds absolutely intriguing because of the art elements to it. And I love the fact that you've got the different European places involved too that are more, I don't want to say obscure, but they're not heard about.
Yeah, they're not maybe as typical. Like it's not happening in London and Paris. There's a little bit in Paris, but I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I never know when I think of things. Like sometimes people will ask you, "Well, why did you decide to set it in Gibraltar?" And I'm like, "Maybe it's because I knew somebody from Gibraltar and I thought that'd make research easy." But maybe it was something else. One of the main elements in it is that Francisco Vella, the artist, is also a color man, which means he sells pigments. And so he would sell those to artists and artisans. And there are a lot of merchants in Gibraltar. And so it makes sense to take a place that, there's the Mediterranean there's the Atlantic, there's tons of trade. You're right near Africa, and that's where tons of that trade went through. So naturally, he'll be from there,
Perfect sense.
Yeah.
Perfect sense. So, well, that's cool. I like it. Okay. So there's just so much in this, and I'm just reading the back cover copy like while we're talking, and I'm going, there's so much in this book. So there's not much more we can cover because we're going to start spoiling stuff if we go too deep
Right.
into it.
Yes.
So all I can say is you definitely want to get the book. It comes out March 26th, and Erin is just like a really good writer. So get the
I just had so much fun writing this book. It was
Yeah.
really a joy. It was fun to like, I love putting stuff that I'm interested into books. So I was realizing just yesterday, I was like, oh my word, you could probably categorize everything I've written as like a class in high school. So like the first one, like there was a lot of history. So that's history class. Then it was English class. And then there's something that's sort of PE because it's hiking. And this is art class. And my last one was music class.
Music
And
class,
so
exactly.
it's just kind of like all the things I enjoyed doing in school, I'm writing about.
So what class have we not written about yet, Erin? What's the
Yeah,
next
well, there's
class?
science and math, and I can handle the science, but I don't know who wants to read a book about math.
I'm not sure
Not
I'll
me.
be high on the list of promoters for that book. I've been to mathematics.
No, thank you.
Oh, it'll be the lady with the mathematical equation is the
I'll
next
call it
title.
chalk dust or something.
Yeah, there you go. Ooh, that'd be good. That'd be good. I kind of like that now. Now I'm thinking. Well, anyway, thank you, Erin, for being here. This is a blast. And everybody go out and get The Lady with the Dark Hair by Erin Bartles. It is published by Revell Publishing, releases on March 26th. You can snag it from Baker Bookhouse and get it for 40% off of pre-order or 30% off after. So,
And free shipping.
free shipping. It's a great place. So,
Amazon can't beat
no, they cannot. They
it.
cannot. Thanks, Erin, for being here.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining Mad Lit Musings, where every conversation is a journey and every book is a new adventure. Subscribe now on your favorite podcast player or check us out on YouTube and let's explore the fascinating intersection of faith, society, and storytelling together.